I was in a coma for 6 weeks while the doctors told my wife I was going to die. When I woke up, she told me the most fantastic story. My team kept running the business without me. Freelancers reached out to my team and said, "We will do whatever it takes as long as Craig's in the hospital." I consider that the greatest accomplishment in my career. My name is Craig Andrews, and this is the Leaders and Legacies podcast, where we talk to leaders creating an impact beyond themselves. At the end of today's interview, I'll tell you how you can be the next leader featured on this show. Today, I want to welcome Jerry Fennema. Jeremy has done everything from counterintelligence to launching a nonprofit in Baltimore. He is the founder of Fennema.io. And there, he's basically a fractional CIO / CTO who helps mid-market companies stabilize messy tech, modernize platforms, and turn complex transformation into reliable execution. If you're thinking that Jeremy is just another managed service provider, that's not the case. He does something very different, very fascinating. And so looking forward to this conversation, because I think every company, especially nothing's changing, you need a good tech platform to build on. And you want a genuine strategist to help you get there. So anyway, Jeremy, welcome.
Thanks, Craig. This is exciting. You know, I always enjoy getting a chance to share a little bit about what I do, and I'm excited to be here and talking with you. So thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, we connected a few weeks ago, and yeah, just kind of an immediate connection. And I just really enjoyed talking to you. And you live in High Point, near where I used to work. Yeah. I lived in Greensboro, but I lived on the other, other side over near Sedgefield. Mm-hmm. But that was really cool. But something you mentioned that caught my interest was you said you got lost in Taiwan.
Yeah. So I used to go to Asia twice a year for like 5 weeks at a time. And it would be like a week and a half or 2 weeks in Taiwan, then a week in Hong Kong, then some time in the Philippines. And then I'd bop around Australia for about 2 weeks, like Brisbane, Sydney, Adelaide, Perth, and then go back home. Or I'd start the other way, start in Australia and end in Taiwan. So the first trip that I took, we started in Australia, and I was getting progressively more foreign, let's say, in the cultures as that, as that trip progressed. And the last place that we were was in Taipei, in Taiwan. What I was not prepared for was the fact that everything in Taiwan is only in Chinese. And so, like, I've navigated in other countries, Mexico, over in Europe. And so it wouldn't be my first time being international, but this was the first time where nothing was in English letters. Like, you couldn't sound out what you were looking for. And so I remember the first time I just left the hotel, I was like, oh, I'm going to go find something to eat. And I couldn't get back to the hotel. Like, I couldn't figure out how to get back there, and no one could help me because no one spoke English. You couldn't just write something down and even show it because they don't read English. It was just a very scary situation to be in. Like, I felt like I was equipped and I could roll with it, but man, it was definitely a learning experience. It was interesting.
What part of Taipei were you in?
I'm trying to think. I couldn't tell you where it was exactly. So there's a Shangri-La hotel that's in Taipei, and that's where we always stayed. And that place was fantastic. But I can't remember exactly where it was. And then we would go between there and a little bit outside of downtown or outside of the central area to a big arena that was kind of on the outside edge of Taipei.
Nehu? In Nehu? Sort of on the north side?
Yeah. Yeah. But
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you the name of it. I don't remember it off the top of my head.
Yeah. I love Taipei.
Oh, yeah.
I love Taiwan. It's my when I used to work in semiconductors, it was, you know, I was doing marketing there. Taiwan was my favorite place in the world to do business because I could stay in the same hotel. And even, you know, it was just short trip over to Hsinchu if we had to go over to
Oh,
Hsinchu and then back to Taipei. And I just found Taipei interesting. I'd like to, you know, I go to the night market
The
and
night market. So, did you know the night market in Taipei is the largest night market in the world?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I found that out from my uncle. So he was in Guam for a number of years and did import export out of China. And when he found out that I was going to Taipei, he's like, "You have to go to the Taiwan night market, to the Taipei night market." He goes, "It's the largest one in Asia." And I'm like, "Really?" And like, I loved it. It was so much fun. And we did the men's night market in Hong Kong as well, which was super cool. But yeah, apparently the one in Taipei is the biggest one.
Yeah, I have some. They're little teacups, Asian teacups. We wouldn't recognize them as teacups. They look more like a little dish that you dip your, you know, you put your soy sauce in. And I still use those. I use those all the time, and I bought those in Taipei. What about Hong Kong? Where would you stay in Hong Kong? Would you stay on Hong Kong Island or Kowloon?
No, in Kowloon. So we stayed a couple of different places. So one of them was right on the water. It was the Intercontinental.
Yep.
And then there's a Shangri-La there, but the Shangri-La there, I don't think is as great as the one in Taipei. And so we stayed there once, and then there was a place that we stayed in Tsim Sha Tsui that was nice. Like it was, and there was a lot of stuff within walking distance of it, so that was kind of cool. It was an older hotel, so it felt like you were staying in like this movie or something like that, you know. And
Oh,
the room keys were like metal room keys, like they were like old school keys, you know, like not even like a normal key that you have these days, but it felt like you were going to the dungeon or something like that. It was this big, like beefy iron thing that opened the door. So it was great.
I would stay normally at the Sheraton right next to the peninsula, so like right by the Intercontinental.
Right there. Yeah.
And I loved it. I loved staying in Kowloon because you look out the window and you're looking at Hong Kong Island, which is beautiful. And so you could see, you know, I just felt like it was a better view in the Sheraton, and it was right there, right by the ferry if you wanted to get over to Hong Kong Island, and right there on Nathan Road. So if you wanted to do some shopping, I
Did
miss
you
it.
get a Chinese name while you were over there?
Yes.
Nice.
So this was in Taiwan. So you know, I lived, I don't know if we talked about this. I lived in
No.
Japan, but I was at a restaurant once and I heard them calling Ando-san, Ando-san. And I was like, oh, they're calling me. And they're like, no, they're calling Ando, which is a Japanese name. And the first character in that name, so that name means safe path. An is safe, do is like road or path. So safe path. So I was in Taiwan once, you know, going around making customer visits. I'm there with, you know, somebody from my company, you know, that I brought over with me, somebody named Jennifer, and our country manager who lived in Taiwan, Cindy. We're sitting there chatting. I was like, hey, Cindy, I need a Chinese name. Maybe something like, you know, Ando. And she's, yeah, because they use the same Chinese characters. And she's like,
Similar,
oh, yeah. We call you Yong Ando. And Jennifer said, what's that mean? She's like, big peace. And she just starts, but we both start busting out laughing. And Cindy has no idea what she just
of
said.
course, yeah, she's not realizing the homonym, right?
So I actually had
Yeah.
business cards made up, you know, big piece.
Big piece. That's awesome. So I had the pleasure of receiving my Chinese name from the head of translations for the company I was working with in Hong Kong. So I would do these trainings while I was over there, and she would do the translation for me into Cantonese for Hong Kong. And she goes, ever all the other people that came over would get six character Chinese names. It would be essentially a phonetic version of what their English name was. And she goes, no. You have to have a real Chinese name. She goes, it should be three characters. And she goes, I'm going to help you with that. So she took like 2 or 3 days and she crafted this Chinese name for me, which is Fang Zhi Luan. And so I honestly think it is probably one of the coolest gifts I have ever been given. So it's always in my signature. I use it, consistently, like people, see it and I get all kinds of compliments on it. And I always, call it back to Celine, who gave it to me. And so I've had it for, well, I don't know, like 20 years now, but it's probably one of the most precious gifts I've ever gotten. It's super cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So what was taking you over to Taiwan and Hong Kong and such?
Yeah, so the company I was working for at the time, so I had done a couple of dot-com startups and one of them failed, one of them succeeded, and that one was a digital marketing agency. So this is in the early 2000s. Most companies didn't have websites, they didn't really know what they were doing with the internet, right? And so I built that up and I had followed this agency model that I had created, and I was using technology from this other company for building out the solutions that my company was providing for small businesses. And so that company looked at it and said, hey, we like what you're doing. We want to do this internally. Like, we want to take your model and productize it. And so they brought me on to head up that division and take this agency model I had built for myself and create, a systemized approach for doing that. And then they wanted to expand it into other countries. So when I first came on board, it was just USA and Canada. And then I brought it to Australia and then Taiwan and Hong Kong and the Philippines and UK, Mexico, Spain, kind of expanded it internationally. So most of what I was doing was going over there and working with these folks like I had been, right? They had a digital marketing agency, or they had a company that they were building around this technology, and they needed to implement this system and leverage that technology effectively. And so I was teaching them this stuff. And in a place like Australia, straightforward, right? It's English, there's cultural differences, just don't be a moron, but like, you can you there's a good frame of reference. But in a place like Taiwan, it's a very different frame of reference. And so you had to think about what are the core philosophies that are essential to what you're doing that don't change? And then what are the things that you're modifying from a cultural context so that you get adoption, right? And so that was a challenge. And then you have the language barrier, right? Because most of the folks don't speak English. And so, at least when I was doing this. And so it was really threading that needle. And there were some preconceived notions about, a white guy from the US coming over and saying, this is how you should follow this system. And so I had a lot of pushback. You don't understand what it's like to be in Taiwan. You don't understand what it's like for our culture. You don't understand how things work here. And they're right. But at the same time, people are people no matter where you go. And one of the core messages that I would have for them is I would say, look at the night market. I loved using the night market as my example. I said, look at the night market. When you go in the night market, you're exchanging money for goods. And if you th they're going to start with a number that's more expensive than that good is worth. And you're going to come back with a number that's less than that good is worth. And you guys are going to go back and forth. And depending on who's more skillful, that's where that price is going to land. I said, that's not specific to Taiwan. That's not even specific to Asian culture. That's something that spans the globe. You can go into the middle of Turkey and you will find a night market that works in the same fundamental principles that the night market here works. Different context for how you start that conversation, different context for or different approach for how that conversation unfolds. But at its core, the same exact thing is happening, that you're negotiating price and that someone, whoever has the more skill, is going to be the one that kind of wins out in that conversation. And I said, that's what I'm trying to explain here. I'm not saying do this in a culturally, in a Western culture fashion, but what I am saying is that there are fundamental things about how we have a conversation that are unique or that are universal across all cultures. And it took me finding someone in the country that could eventually become that became an evangelist for me, that I could essentially teach the system to, and then they could then take that and run with it before the success really kicked off. So Taiwan had lagged a lot of the other markets in implementing it, but once I found the right, evangelist for it, man, it went crazy, and the technology really took off.
And I think that's kind of a universal thing. Even here in the US, is if you have a different idea that you're trying to get in, you have to have an evangelist of someone other than you who's going around doing the blocking and tackling and convincing others.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think it depends too, right? I mean, there's a lot of startups. Like, I'm working with one right now, a startup, and the leaders, the two co-founders, are the evangelists, and they have a really great story about why this is important and what they're trying to accomplish and why it means so much. And so I think, they don't need someone else to accomplish that, but when you're in an environment that starts to expand outside of where you have a personal connection, right, where you have resonance in that culture, whatever that culture context is, that's where you start to need an evangelist, right? Because you're there's that microcosm, that society, whatever that is, starts to see you as external. And so when that happens, you can either try and convince them that you're not external, which, I mean, really isn't the case. I mean, you are external until you're not.
And when
Or
you're
you
based in
can,
Taiwan, that's a hard sale.
right? Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't care how great I am. I'm never going to become the Taipan, per se, right? So, but you've got you've an easier path, really, is to find someone that's in that culture that then becomes your bridge.
Yeah. And so what is it you're doing now? Because you're not doing not spreading marketing agencies, planting marketing agencies and systems. What are you doing now?
Yeah, so what was interesting was as I started to do that model, there were more and more features and systems that needed to get developed, right? And I had a pretty strong background in development before that. And so I started just doing more and more application development in that role, and that kind of grew over time. And then I became a CTO, and then did a bunch of other things, and most recently a CIO. And I started to build up this skill around technology and strategy and product development. And so in 2023, the company I was working with had some internal reshuffle when one of the founders passed away. And so I found myself looking for something new. And I thought, you know what? What if I start up my own fractional practice doing CIO or CTO consulting? And a lot of times those things get conflated, right? You have a lot of people that are CTOs that envision themselves as CIOs. You have a lot of CIOs that envision themselves as CTOs, but those are two very different things. And I've got experience in both of those. And so I can wear both of those hats, and I'll work with companies that are typically in a growth phase. And from a CIO standpoint, they are probably spending money on technology, but they don't know if that's aligned with their strategy and what they're trying to do from a growth perspective. And so what I can do is come in and review that, help them make sure that they do have something that's aligned, or build a strategy if they don't, and turn that into a roadmap and then an execution plan. And that's something that really differentiates me from a lot of the people that are out there from a CIO perspective, is there's a lot of folks that will come in They'll create a playbook for you, they'll give you the playbook, and then they're out. And I find that that's just a bad plan. And so what I want to do is I want to be part of the execution of that plan because I'm the one who best knows what that should look like because I created the plan for them, right, with them. And so we'll deputize folks internally and then figure out, what external players do we have to bring in.
And so there's a lot of people listening, myself to a certain degree, that when I hear these titles, I think, oh, you're the one that helps, you pick the computers and the networking and the server, and when something goes down, I call you. But that's not what you do.
No, not typically. So what I do is make sure that those people that are making those decisions and those decisions that are being made are ones that are the healthiest for the company. Right now, most companies they have a pain point, and there's a salesman that walks in the door and says, "I solved that pain point." And the CEO is like, "Oh, good, because I have that pain point. Please solve it." And they end up with this sort of chock-a-block environment where there's all this individual solutions for individual problems, right? And there's not strategy. And so what you're describing, what computer should I have? What network should I have? Who do I call when there's a problem? Those are all tactical issues, right? Those are all firefighting type issues. And where strategy comes into play is to just stop people from lighting fires, right? Instead of putting more fire extinguishers around the office, why don't we get people to stop lighting the fires, and then we only need one or two fire extinguishers? So it's looking to make sure that you have the right kind of infrastructure in place. What does that mean in terms of on-premise versus cloud? What's the mix? Why would we do one versus the other? What kind of technology do we have? What are we doing from a mobile device standpoint? How are we positioning our people to be effective in the environment that they are in, right? These are all strategic decisions that determine how an individual contributor or how a team is able to do their job and be effective at it. And so we'll have policy and governance and strategy that then flows down to these other things. And if the organization doesn't have somebody that's helping with the question, "Hey, my laptop's not working, what do I do?" Right? Again, that's not me, but we need to have somebody who's doing that. And so that's either working with an external agency to be able to provide that expertise, or who do we deputize internally that we can help do that, or how do we make them more effective so they are accomplishing that task for the organization that we have?
Do you find that MSPs, so let's say that there's an organization that has an MSP that's doing those lower level tasks. Do you find MSPs are happy when you show up or feel like you're a little bit of a threat?
No, I mean, I guess they could feel like it's a threat if they didn't understand what we're doing, right? In my experience, the MSPs in an organization, or the ones that I, build relationships with, love it because they know that they're spending all their time fighting fires, and they really wish people would just stop lighting the fires so they didn't have to fight them as much, right? And once they understand that I'm not the person who's trying to compete with them from service level, but instead I'm the person who's trying to restructure what's happening internally in the company so that the MSP is more effective in what they're trying to accomplish, they become an advocate of mine. So I have a number of MSPs that I've built great relationships with that I'll bring in. But if the company's already working with one, then terrific. Like, I want them to work with me so that we can make their job more effective. And they, most of the time, know that what's missing is strategy. What's missing is alignment with goals and execution. And what's not there are clear policies, but they're not empowered to have those conversations with them and with leadership. And they're just not in that role. And so I think it ends up being frustrating more often than not.
Yeah, I bet. One of the things I would imagine has to be really hard is figuring out where AI shows up in the strategy. Because it's so in flux. What do you pin down? What do you aim at?
So the story that I try and share with leadership around AI is I find that analogies or lived experiences tend to be the kind of thing that they can latch on, that leadership in general can, people in general can latch on to. So the story that I tell is when I bought a welder. So a couple of years ago, I learned welding as a hobby, and then I went out and bought a welder. And when I did that, every project became a welding project. Didn't matter if metal was the way to go or not. I had a welder. I wanted to use it. It became a welding project. I needed to build a trellis for the garden. Let's build it out of metal, right? I need to, build some sort of frame to hold something together. It didn't matter that wood was really the best option. Nope, let's do it in metal because I got a welder. And I think that's where AI is these days, is that people are excited or they're afraid around AI. They don't want to be the one that's not doing it. And so everything becomes an AI project. And it's the question on leadership's mind is, how can we use AI to solve a problem? And that's just the wrong way to go about it. The question we should ask is, what are the problems that we have to solve? And then what's the best way to solve those problems? Now, AI may be the best way to solve that problem, and that's great. But a lot of times it's not. And when you start using that power tool, AI, to solve problems where it's misaligned, then what you end up doing is you end up spending a lot of money and you end up not getting the results that you want to get. And it's just a bad situation overall. And so that's something I've written a lot of articles on LinkedIn. And it's something that I talk with teams about quite a bit, is helping them have the right framework for how they're positioning that conversation and trying to recognize what their motivation is, right? When they actually are working it from a place of fear, they don't want to be the ones that aren't doing the thing. The best way to surface that is to just realize that that's how you're operating. Because once you become aware of that, you don't have to fight against it. Just giving it awareness, giving it some sunlight, helps you be a lot more objective about what you're trying to accomplish.
And we were talking in the green room about keyboards and mice. When I bought this mouse, I told you my favorite mouse died, and so I had to buy a new one, and they didn't make it anymore. And there was this mouse, and then there was another mouse that was identical, except it was the AI mouse. And what the AI mouse had a little button on the top that you could press that would bring up a chat GPT screen. Well, all the buttons on this mouse are programmable, so you can
You could do the
program any
same
button
thing.
to do the same thing. But it was $20 more for the AI mouse. And I was like, well, that looks stupid.
That is such a great example of what so many people are doing these days with their technology. They are putting an AI label on it because that lets them, it's a marketing angle, right? We're just going to AI it. And it alleviates this FOMO that leadership has, right? Because they want to also say to whoever their stakeholders are, the board or whoever, hey, we have AI'd it. Like we've got it covered. We've got AI on our stuff. Right. And as long as they can put that label on it, then they feel like they've done something. And that's the most useless activity for them, to be honest.
Inexpensive. Inexpensive. It would cost me 30% more, or for, actually 50% more. It was 50% more to get the AI mouse, which.
One of the other examples, I was just, this wasn't that long ago, the company was looking at demand planning. And they were trying to find, they had an 80% of their SKUs were not forecastable. And so but in their mind, they thought, well, if we get AI, AI will solve it, right? I talked to this guy who said, our AI-based forecasting model can forecast everything. It doesn't matter. And I tried to explain to the team, you can get a forecast from the system. It doesn't mean it's going to be right. It just means it's a forecast and that AI is extremely confident in it. But again, it's not reality. And so the question is, like, how valuable is that? I mean, you could have a dartboard on a wall and throw darts at it and get the same level of a forecast from it. Like, you just feel silly doing it there and you feel like you're empowered when you're doing it with AI. But the fundamental data underneath, it's not forecastable. And so it doesn't matter where that's coming from. It's still going to be wrong as much times as it's going to be right.
Yeah. So one thing I'd like to touch on was, before we wrap up, I was listening to a podcast. It was really fascinating. So a little bit of the background was one of the people on the podcast had taken a couple Mac studios and daisy chained them together and was running his own private LLM.
Oh, nice.
And he was using Kimi to set up, basically workers or agents inside that. And the discussion they were having was, basically we'd spent 20 years moving to the cloud where all of our data went from on-premise to the cloud. And the problem with a lot of the large language models is, I have some proprietary things that I do. And if I do them in one of these models, they're no longer proprietary. They're out there. And so they were questioning, are we going to see kind of a reverse trend where we bring some of the infrastructure in-house where we have control of our large language models?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. So there's a couple of pieces to unpack in that. So one is that depending on how you're interacting with and what AI agents you're interacting with, there's greater or lesser controls that you can put in place around privacy. So you don't have to have a local model to have good safeguards in place around privacy for AI. Even on the lowest end plans, like if you've got ChatGPT plus or whatever it is, right? There's still controls that you can put in there to say, look, don't use my data for training purposes. I want to be able to control the scope and things like that. Now, they can still override that if they're finding that there's a reason for them to do it or someone else needs to look at it. The federal government decides that they need to review what you're doing or something like that. Those things then go away. But for many people, there are enterprise class protections that you can put in place around commercially available large language models that, are pretty decent for most folks. But that cloud client, client server, client local back and forth has been going on since computers became, it started in existence, right? It was a client server model for many, many years, and then it became, a local server model, and then it became client server again, and now we're shifting back to local some. The short answer is it depends. It should always be a conversation. Should this end up in the cloud? Why? Should this be local? Why? And you want to have someone who understands the value of both of those to be able to help you make that determination. There are some really great use cases for having things be on premise, not the least of which is performance. I was talking with a company that not that long ago that had all of their warehouse management solution and their automation for their warehouse running on local servers because they wanted a certain amount of resiliency and they needed certain performance that you wouldn't be able to guarantee from the cloud. Okay, I think that's a great use case for it, right? You've got other environments where moving everything to the cloud is less expensive or it's more reliable, but they don't need, the bandwidth exchange, and they can deal with, having that cloud environment being down for fractions of a second here or there, right? So it just varies. But, if you take a holistic approach and look at, what is the company trying to handle and what are the risks associated with that? And then you balance and say, this is where I want to be from a risk profile standpoint. That's really what's going to determine where you want to land.
Well, that's fascinating. It'd be interesting to see how things go. Jeremy, Thank you. This has been great. How can people reach you?
Yeah, for sure. So my website, fenema.io, so FENNEMA.io is a great place. I also wanted to let I like to give in these podcast environments, be able to give something back to people who engage with it. So I have something specific for your audience that I wanted to share. So if you go to my website, there's a contact form at the bottom, and you fill it out and you say, I heard about you from the Leaders and Legacies podcast. What I'll provide for you is a complimentary executive technology alignment review, which is normally something that I put in a couple of hours for, and it's a few hundred dollars of value. And what I'll do is compare your growth goals, your current IT spend, and your active initiatives, and give you a couple of clear recommendations that you could follow. And there's no obligation, there's no pitch or anything. Just I'm happy to do that for your team. So if you go to fenema.io, you can find me there, and all my contact information is there. And then the contact form at the bottom is the best way to let me know.
That's awesome. Thank you, Jeremy.
For sure. And Craig, this has been fun. I really enjoyed this. This has been a great conversation, and I'm glad that you invited me. So thank you.
Oh, it's been a delight. Yeah, thanks for coming on Layers and Legacies.
This is Craig Andrews. I want to thank you for listening to the Leaders and Legacies podcast. We're looking for leaders to share how they're making impact beyond themselves. If that's you, please go to alliesforme.com/guest and sign up there. If you got something out of this interview, we would love you to share this episode on social media. Just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post it on the socials. If you know someone who would be a great guest, tag them on social media and let them know about the show, including the hashtag Leaders and Legacies. I love seeing your posts and suggestions. We are regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you don't miss anything, please go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me. It means a lot to my team. If you want to know more, please go to alliesforme.com or follow me on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.